Working Class Audio is brought to you by Universal Audio, Audio Technica, Loudon Audio, Focal Monitors, and Gearsluts.com.
This is the Working Class Audio Podcast, session 140.
Working Class Audio, navigating the world of recording with a working class perspective. Here's your host, Matt Boudreau.
Thanks, Chuck. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Working Class Audio Podcast. This is session 140 you're listening to. And damn it, this cup of coffee I made is so good. I'm going to take a sip of it right the hell now. That is magic in a cup if I've ever tasted it. Man, I wish you could try it. Anyhow, 140. Yeah, trucking along. We'll see how 150 goes. But today, 140, you're going to love it. Robert Scoville, live sound engineer, Grammy Award-winning live sound engineer, who's worked with Prince, Rush, Def Leppard, Matchbox 20, and of course, the one band everybody knows him for, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, who I've seen probably four or five times in the last 10 years. And it always sounds good, I got to tell you. He's been with Tom Petty for 23 years. He's also a senior product specialist for Avid with regards to the venue line of live sound consoles. So he knows his gear backwards and forwards, and he definitely knows how to make a live show sound good, I can tell you from experience. So really honored to have him on. We have been doing the email back and forth now for a couple months, just because he's traveling, I'm traveling, different things come up. We both have families and, it gets crazy. So Robert Scoville coming up. Can't wait to have you hear that. Oh, and by the way, we're going to talk some health stuff. So if you're into that, I'm excited for you. If you're not into that, then get a box of donuts, sit in the lazy boy and get ready to get schooled by Mr. Scoville on what he calls HTFU, harden the fuck up. Yeah, we'll talk more about that. So I just got back from taking my two sons to the used computer store in Berkeley, California. And I tell you, I don't know if you're anything like me, but man, I go into a store like that and just, I don't care how old the computer is. I'm looking at all these relics thinking, what could I do with that? What could I make with that? I could make a server. I could put all my client stuff on there. I start to rationalize and go through all of the possibilities in my head. And I just pull back and go, you know what? You are such a geek. You don't need any of this stuff. So anyhow, we're trying to come up with a gaming machine, a step up from where my youngest son is at. Yes, my sons play video games and I let them, and I police what they do. I don't let them totally go to town on, Grand Theft Auto and all that. You know, there's some rules, but they do play games, they enjoy it, and we're at the process of trying to, I keep getting it's the 21st century when your kids are saying, "Dad, this game is so laggy." So, I always explain, "Well, you got the video card and RAM and the system drive, blah, 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 blah." And I just, start to rattle off all this stuff. So we're going to try to up their game a little bit, up the 9-year-old's game a little bit on his computer, because his older brother has more of a gaming machine than he does. And I feel like I should sort that out. But where am I going with that? I'm telling you, I have brought this up before, and I'm an advocate of minimalism. And even though I am, I got to say, I'm really happy that I've hung on to some of the stuff that I have, that I've put to use. I've got although it is on like permanent loan for the last, 5 years, the Studer cassette deck, this Panasonic DAT machine that I bought new in, 93, 94, something like that. Both still work. I've got this mini disc player too. Anyway, the long and short of it is I'm just going to hold on to this stuff, because what are you going to get for a DAT machine? $75, $200 at the top, if that. And a cassette machine, this one doesn't even record properly, but it does play back really well. So I'm going to hold on to it. And then, the mini disc thing, it's rare I get a mini disc request, but I personally have some mini disc recordings of like ambient stuff that I've done, or, you know, sounds of streets and trains and all that kind of stuff. That's another level of dorkness that I'm willing to admit to right here and now on this podcast. So anyhow, and once again, where am I going with that? Well, I've been restoring some cassette only recordings of some material from my previous band, the Sextants, from many years ago. And we're going to be putting that out. And we're in the process of changing over our whole catalog to a different aggregator. In fact, DistroKid, who we've talked about DistroKid on Working Class Audio many episodes ago, probably 100 episodes ago. They have a good deal. So I'll give them a shout out to, if you want a good deal, you want to go check that out. Or if you want something cool to recommend to your clients in terms of their music catalog and getting it out there in the digital world, well, check out DistroKid. That's pretty cool. So that's what I've been doing. Yeah, a lot of restoration. Also still in the looking, and if any of you have one of these, I'm just going to put a request out. I'm on the hunt for the ability to restore. I've got numerous 8-track quarter inch reels of recordings from the Sextants, and we need to restore these things. They were done on a Fostex R8, and I keep seeing R8s out in the world for like, you know, $500-$600. And I'm like, no way. Sorry, that's not going to fly, especially since those machines don't last and who knows what's wrong with them. So if any of you have one, or if you have a machine that you think is equivalent, hit me up, matt@workingclassaudio.com. I know I'm using the podcast for my own personal gain here for my band from the past. So, but I have these recordings and I really want to get them transferred and I want to get them out in the world because, you know how it is. You got these recordings sitting around and you just don't want them to go to waste. So there it is. So I could just buy the machine and transfer the stuff and then resell the machine. Hell, I'll even borrow it from you if you want to ship it to the Bay Area. I know it's a tall order. Anyhow, let me know. A couple shout outs. First of all, Universal Audio, the Apollo Rack Dream Studio promo is coming to an end on the 31st. I've said it time and time again, and I know I keep hitting you over the head with it, but I just want to emphasize that, you know, you don't want to go on September 1st to go buy an Apollo and go, oh man, I didn't do it when Matt said to do it, because, you know, you're going to lose out on all those free plugins. So make sure you do that. Go to uaudio.com and check it out. And also, I want to give a shout out to thegearsluts.com, one of our other sponsors. Speaking of buying tape machines for transfer purposes, I spend a large amount of time looking on the classifieds over there. And if you're in the market for some used gear, I would definitely encourage you to go check it out there, because there's large amounts of listings there. And it's a great resource if you're looking for something used. So there it is. We are done. The monologue is finished. The cup of coffee is almost finished. So I'm going to slam this down and we're going to get into our interview with the great Robert Scoville. So let's do that. Let's take one big sip. Everybody do it together. Raise your cup. Ready? Don't choke and don't shoot it out your nose either. Damn good cup of coffee. All right, here we go. Robert Scoville here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Yeah, cool to be here for sure.
It's great to meet you because I've known your name forever and I've always associated you with Tom Petty. And, you know, I don't know a lot of live sound people's names by heart, but I've known yours for years. You know, I don't know how long you've been with Tom, but...
I've been with him since 94. I started with him right at Wildflowers. That was the first tour I did for him, so...
Well, I think I've seen Tom Petty play probably 4 times in the last decade.
Yeah.
And every time I've seen him, I've been stunned with how incredible it sounded. Not just blowing smoke up your ass, but... I mean, it really just it sounded outstanding. And in fact... In particular, at the Greek Theater in Berkeley, California, was one time I saw him. And I don't know if it's a psychosomatic thing where, because I know you're running sound, because I knew your name then, and I thought, oh, Robert's doing sound, so obviously it's going to sound good. So, but it did sound really good.
The opposite can happen there too. You know, I've had it happen where people know I'm mixing the show, and the afterwards, it's a little bit of like, wow, that's all he's got? Okay. Wow. That's a bit of a letdown there. I my expectations were a little higher. I know that's how it works for me some nights.
Wow, he's really sucking tonight.
Yeah.
And then I've seen him like at the Fillmore. Yeah, I mean, truly outstanding job. Every time I've seen it, I'm like, how live sound should be. It should sound that good.
I really, really appreciate that. And, you know, I'll give certainly some of the credit where the credit's due. They can make you look good a lot of nights. You know, I mean, that's a pretty good band up there. They know what they're doing.
Funny how when the talent gets better, we all sound better.
Yeah.
Let me go back a bit.
Sure.
How did you get into live sound? What was the critical moment?
What you mean as a professional, or how did I just get interested in it?
As a professional, what was the set of circumstances that set you up to start doing live sound?
I'd kind of always known I wanted to do it. I mean, really, since I was a teenager, kind of knew I wanted to do it. So I was kind of driving toward that, you know, all through my high school years and in the first part of going to college. I went to a technical institute in Kansas City, studying for a double E in electronics design, electronic engineering. And because I thought that's what I needed to get into professional sound work, only to find out that I really probably didn't need to get into that. But long story short, you know, the school that I was at, there was a sound company, a local sound company in Kansas City named Superior Sound, a big regional company, pretty powerful player there in the region. And they had put up a notice at the school saying they were looking for volunteers for a weekend run of shows. You know, it was every weekend over the course of the summer. They were doing these big series of park shows. And I mean, they were big shows. I mean, they'd have, you know, 15, 20,000 people come to these events. So I went down and volunteered the first week for that. And, you know, as happens probably for more 19-year-olds than we want to count, you know, I didn't get called back, but decided to just keep going down and working basically for free for a summer just to try to get my foot in the door there. And sure enough, did. And, you know, that was kind of my first stepping stone into pure live sound. I was just so fortunate to get hooked up with an incredible set of mentors there. I mean, they had some really, really great people working at that place. And I actually revere it more now than I did certainly when I was 19 or 20 years old. I really understand what I was involved in there. You know, it was really a great thing.
Were there early mentors for you?
Yeah, without a doubt. I've thanked them more times in my life than I can count because, I mean, I look back on it and just go, wow, if I didn't have that person in my life at that stage in my life, no way do I make it where I'm at right now. No way. No way possible. So, I mean, it was a couple of people in particular, two or three people. There was a gentleman named Steve Russian working there who really kind of took me under his wing. I don't know whether he had a just soft spot for me or what, but he took me under his wing and, you know, really showed me a lot about how things work, functionally how they work. And then there was another guy there that I really want to give some credit to named Mitch Leggett, who is, you know, has since passed on. But, you know, he was kind of my mentor into how to handle yourself on a show day. Like, you know, when we would go out and do shows together, you know, he was really a top-notch guy. I mean, a really professional guy. And I really always admired how well he handled himself, you know, with the client, with everything. You know, I really absorbed a lot of that. And then from another part of the technical aspect, there was a gentleman there named Ken Patterson, who was an ex-Altec Lansing guy. And, you know, the story has it that he held some Altec Lansing patents and all kinds of stuff. So I really got the real technical end of audio, you know, acoustics and audio from him. So, you know, between those three guys, man, I mean, that was a serious school for a 19-year-old, believe me.
To me, live sound folks really, I don't know, I hate to say they're more ballsy than studio folks, but there's something about doing live sound that is just like, I know that I did it a few times and I was like, oh, I don't know. I think I'm going to stay in the studio. And I know that there's, you know, more to it. I've talked to Vance Powell a lot about this because he had his early days were spent doing live sound and flying PAs. And there's a lot of heavy work and a lot of potentially dangerous work that comes in the world of live sound, not just, you know, talking dangerous of, you know, mixing a live show, but more like physically dangerous with equipment and the odds of getting hurt.
I mean, obviously as a mixer, you know, I don't really, you know, I'm not doing any heavy lifting anymore, you know, I mean, for the most part.
You're kind of past that,
you know, now I'm kind of past that now, but you know, in the early days, certainly. But having said that, you know, there is a physicality to it in live sound that was appetizing to me as a young man, for sure. I mean, I certainly did my share of studio work, you know, at the same time I was working at Superior. I was doing a lot of studio work, moonlighting and session work and stuff there. And, you know, I kind of carried that on through the 80s, really 80s and into the 90s. But there was always something about, you know, the traveling aspect of it. I love that part of it. There is something about the immediacy of it, meaning, you know, it doesn't matter how good or how bad things are going, mm-hmm. the house lights are going to go out at 8 o'clock and we're going to do a show. You know, I mean, you know, there's this kind of, hey, you got to make it work. You got to find a way to make this all go. It's kind of that, it's, you know, kind of that warrior mentality a little bit, you know, I mean, you got to run at challenges, not run away from them, you know, and there are certain people that are meant to be out there doing that. And then there are certain mentalities and people that are not well inclined to be in that, you know.
The road, of course, brings a lot of challenges. And to the best of my knowledge, you're a family man.
I am.
And I'd like to know how you balance that.
It's hard. I'm not going to lie to you. And, you know, to some degree, I'd love to say it's harder on me than my wife and my kids, but I actually think it's harder on them. You know, that family unit thing is really important. I've tried to really respect it over the course of my years. You know, I mean, I went into it, you know, eyes wide open, and I was on the road when I met my wife. So we didn't really kind of fall into that trap of, you know, being married for a period of years and then me deciding to go on the road. You know, I think that's infinitely more difficult to do. You know, it just puts infinitely more strain on the relationship because you've already established a lifestyle and now are going to really disrupt that to go on the road. You know, I have a lot of people that ask me for advice on that, and man, it is a really, really tough one. So, you know, in my situation, we met while I was touring. So there was always this aspect of that being in place, even when we decided to have children, you know, so it was already established. It wasn't going to be totally disruptive. And we kind of put some ground rules in place really early on in our relationship. We kind of figured it out. I don't know how to explain it other than that at about the 3-week mark, if we went longer than 3 weeks without being in the same room together and being able to communicate and hang and do all the things, then it started to drift apart. You know, so we kind of made this commitment of, didn't matter what the circumstances were, if we were coming up on 3 weeks, you have to come out and be with me and we have to hang together for a while. Because it's like, you can only do so much on the phone. Like you can connect on the phone a little bit, talk about the things. And then as soon as you're off the phone, your lives go completely in separate directions. You know, it's not that didn't matter. That conversation didn't matter, but you know, you're just completely spread apart again. Mm-hmm. It's hard to grow a relationship in that situation, you know? So we had to have that time together. So it just became cost of doing business. You know, it's like, okay, this is just a cost of the lifestyle. You have to come out. And we held on to that for a long time. Even after we had kids, it's like, okay, well, the kids have to come out. If I'm going to be on this extended tour, we have to make ways for them to come out. We buy the extra hotel room, the extra transport, whatever it is. I mean, you got to commit to the marriage and the relationship. You know?
Is it hard when you're working on a high level with someone like Tom Petty to integrate your family into the system, so to speak? You know, I mean, there's an ecosystem within the Tom Petty camp of all the crew and the band and everybody. So when somebody wants to introduce an outside group of people and or element, does that challenge everybody a bit? Or is everybody accommodated?
It can. I think overall, I mean, I've been really, really fortunate with some of the acts that I've worked with. I mean, whether it's Tom for certain or the Rush guys or even the Def Leppard guys. I mean, I'm not blind to not know that, you know, part of my position helps have make this happen. You know, I mean, my position and my role in the whole thing, but they've always been so accommodating to that. I mean, just overly accommodating to it. I think because they understand it and they welcome them. I mean, I have, you know, pictures of all my kids with the guys with Rush, with, you know, Def Leppard, you know, all these guys, you know, Tom, everybody, you know, they have been so warm and receptive to that whole thing, you know. So I've been really, really fortunate with that.
That's good.
You know, if they need to make room on the buses, you know, the guys are always so accommodating for it. I mean, they just treat my wife and family like gold. So, matter of fact, my daughter is now out touring with us on Tom Petty. She does wardrobe for the band and helps out in the production office now, you know. So,
how many kids do you have?
I have three. I have a daughter, 21, a son, 18, and a son, 13.
Oh, wow. Outnumbered with three.
yeah, we made the first mistake, right? We had an odd number and it ended up being more than two. So, you know, they always say, don't let yourself get outnumbered, right?
How long have you been married, though?
We have been married. We will be 26 years this year and have been together coming up on 30. We dated. We actually got married 3 years to the day that we met.
So it's interesting because you're, if I'm doing the math right, I mean, your relationship, well, yeah, I am doing the math right. Your relationship started well before the internet.
Probably right at the tip of it. Right, yeah. Now. I mean, you know, right at the, I was probably carrying my Radio Shack TRS-80 at that point, you know, so I was probably trying to do email and get on the PAN network, if I remember right now.
All the things we have available to us now to communicate, has that made it any easier to be away from the family?
Without question. Mm. Without question. I mean, just the consistency and the constant communication that you can carry on. You know, I can carry on 4 conversations with each one of my family members all at the same time, even if they're in completely different places, through text and FaceTime and email, everything. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. And you know, the place where it really, really plays big is when you're traveling internationally now. You know, to be able to use those methods to stay in touch and stay connected, not only to your family, but to the goings on in the world, man. I mean, I can remember touring, you know, extensive parts of the world, you know, or, you know, out into the world in the early 80s and through that period before, you know, I mean, when we were still on payphones and all the other thing. And man, you could get so isolated where you just felt so disconnected from the Western world, you know? And I don't feel that way at all anymore. Matter of fact, you know, I mean, I just got back from India. I was there for a week doing some teaching and some mixing clinics over there. And I mean, I didn't even feel like I was away from home. I mean, obviously the culture's different there, but you know, between the phone and the internet, everything, it's just so easy now compared to what it used to be.
Now, if they could just do something about that time difference, because my wife actually has to travel to India in October, and it's always like, okay, now wait, how many hours away are you going to be?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, India's an interesting one too. And not to go down the rabbit hole here, but you know, talking time zones, you know, it's interesting, at least for me, you know, when I go that far, because literally you're on the direct opposite side of the world, you know, from the West Coast of the United States. So it's literally about 12 and a half hours difference. So if it's midnight where you are, it's noon at home, you know. And there's something about that time change that does not mess with me. Like I can make that trip and not jet lag one inch, you know.
Wow.
But boy, send me from the West Coast to London, where it's only, you know, 5-6 hours of time change difference. Oh my God, it just crushes me. Absolutely crushes me, especially if I fly east. Something about flying east, man. I mean, I will be falling asleep in my soup at 6 o'clock. You can count on it. I mean, it's just amazing.
Yeah, when you go west, though, it's like, you know, you feel like you're a superhero of time because you've got the jump on everybody.
Well, that's the old joke, right? When you get there, give me the lotto numbers.
So, you know, being on the road, the family challenges we've discussed. But the health thing, this is interesting to me. I just subscribed to your YouTube channel, was watching the HTFU, Harden the Fuck Up.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Well, Harden the Fuck Up. This all kind of stemmed from something kind of late in my life. And, you know, I'm just going to tell you, Matt, I'm one of these people. I'm convinced I'm living my life completely backwards, because through this 20 or 30 years of touring in my life, you know, in my 20s and 30s, I golfed. And in my 50s and 60s, I'm doing these high-intensity endurance events. You know, I'm just backwards. You know, most guys are golfing and retiring at this point in their life. I'm doing world's toughest mudder, you know. So I got hooked up with a guy here. The whole story, it all stems back to a neighbor that I had here who I used to hang out with all the time. Really great guy here. And he got me started on some fitness stuff when I was probably in my very late 40s, maybe just turning 50. And we decided to take on some events, and we started going to CrossFit, you know, that whole 9 yards. But the first event I took on was the Alcatraz swim. I wanted to do the Alcatraz swim, or we talked about it, you know, at a party. You know, he had done it the year before, and I was like, oh my God, they let you do that? I mean, that's an actual event. I'm in. Let's go. I'll start training for it right now. So, you know, we started training for it, and that was the first kind of, you know, big endurance event I did, you know. And through training for that event, I hooked up with another guy here in Scottsdale, fantastic guy named Luke Kayem, who is a fitness trainer, fitness expert here. And he was training guys to get ready for Navy SEALs. You know, he was training them to get him ready to go to Kakura and do all the SEAL fit stuff. So, you know, I kind of hooked up with him and started taking all these classes. And I got really, I don't want to say addicted to it, but, you know, what I started realizing right away was the impact that it was having on my mentality and the impact it was having on my energy level. You know, it's not just a fitness program. I mean, it's a life change. I mean, you're talking about changing your diet. You're talking about, you know, it's not, we're going to do a 6-week workout program here. This is life change. I mean, you're going to do this for the rest of your life. So I've kind of picked that up and integrated it into my touring where, you know, there's a workout element of my tour, you know, my tour schedule that goes on. Part of it is all about kind of to train and get ready for these other events. Like I mentioned, World's Toughest Mudder. I'm going to do that again this year in November, which is a 24-hour endurance race. But I've become really a big, big fan of it. And I know it's not that I want to preach it, that everybody should do it, but it is definitely what works for me. And kind of the whole harden the fuck up thing came out of these kind of workouts where it was not just about hardening up your body and that aspect of it, but it was about hardening up your mentality, you know, your outlook. And yeah, and I know guys, everybody's going to cringe when I say this because it sounds so fluffy, but it's so true, is that it kind of builds this warrior spirit in you where you have to learn not to quit. And it teaches you not to quit. And not only that, it teaches you to run at challenges, not run away from them. You know, I mean, it's just a mentality that gets built into it, into your mind when you're doing these types of events. I mean, if you're an easy quitter, you won't do well in these things. You just won't. And I'm a believer that if you have that kind of mentality, you don't survive very well on the road too, because all the obstacles are there. All the reasons are there to quit, to give up, you know, all of these things. I just don't want those to be a part of my mentality. They never have been for the most part, but this has really, really reinforced that for me. And, I'm different mentally and physically right now than I've ever been in my life. I will say.
I spent time on the road as a musician first. And, that's the only time I've spent on the road. And the possibilities of derailing yourself with bad diet, abuse of alcohol or drugs, lack of physical activity really can just hammer you. And I just had a taste of it in my mid-20s and didn't do it for very long. And finally, I was like, I'm gonna stay in the studio and be a recording engineer.
Right.
So I'm sure that you've been at this so long that this is like the new plateau for you to stay healthy on the road and stay mentally aware.
Yeah, honestly, it's affected me probably mentally easily as much, if not more, than it has physically. Mm-hmm. Like I notice my energy level, my focus, my stamina on the road now is fantastic. I mean, I just feel like I could go on. I mean, you know, and part of it is I've been doing it my whole life, so it's really kind of all I've known. So, you know, I kind of look at this portion of it now as kind of refinement of this whole process of touring, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a very refined lifestyle for me. I'm very disciplined and very kind of methodical about it. Even the guys I work with in the pedicamp, because they've seen me kind of take this next level now, you know, they look at me and just go, what the hell are you doing? You know, I'm there at 6 o'clock in the morning when the riggers are there, you know, doing my stair routines and stuff. And, you know, I mean, I'm not going to go to work for another 10 hours, you know, but I want to be there. I want to be part of it. And I'm way more engaged now than I've ever been on the road, for sure.
And it's interesting because I think, I'm a big fan of the beginner's mindset of always just trying to learn as much as you can about your craft. And I'm sure that, you know, over the years, you have taken your craft of live sound to a new level. And this is, you know, another craft that helps you take your physical and your mental state to another level. So those two really can work in tandem.
Truly, truly. Because you can, I mean, it can lull you to sleep on tour. And I speak from experience here. I've been there where, you know, so many things can drag on you emotionally on tour because people have a hard time believing this, but it's absolutely true. I mean, here you are sitting in the middle of 18,000 people a night. You're traveling with 30 or 40 people that you're spending 24 hours a day with. And it can be the most lonely existence you've ever had in your life. You know, I mean, it can be a lonely place and, you know, nothing more revealing of it. And I still struggle with this part of it. Me and my wife talk about this sometimes. You know, all of the day can be really great, but the minute you walk into that hotel room and there's nothing there but that bed and television, no family, no nothing, none of your tour mates, nothing, man. I mean, that's a stark reality. And it's like, ooh, man, it makes me just kind of go, I have to do anything to get out of this room right now. I mean, I just cannot hang here. I will come and sleep here, but I have to go out and explore the city, go do some record shopping, whatever it's going to be. But if I just sit there and sink into the bed, I mean, here we go. I mean, you know, it just tumbles downhill from there. I just am not wired that way. I just can't do it, you know?
Robert Scoville here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. Well, you know, it's that time. We're going to do a sponsor break here with our friends over at Audio Technica. I have some bad news. When I was in New Mexico and I was working on the podcast a couple podcasts ago, I had my headphones on the kitchen table at my parents' house, and I'll be damned, you know, I have dropped these ATH M40Xs probably 1,000 times. They drop probably twice a day. I drop them on the floor because I'm not hanging them up properly. And I'll be damned, I just made a sudden movement and shot those headphones across the floor. And my parents in their in the kitchen area have a tile floor. Damn it, I broke them. I broke this one little piece. And I'm on the fence. The cushions are so nicely worn, and you know how we get sentimental about them. So I'm going to do one of two things. I'm either going to see about getting this one little piece fixed because the wire's not broke, the headphones still work technically, and I could tape them up like I would tape my glasses up if I was as big of a nerd as I tell you I am. But, you know, if I do decide to go get them and rebuy them, you know, the good news is these are under $100. I'm going to say that these ATH M40Xs for the last couple of years have been a really good value for the money. And while I'm not ready to give this pair up yet, I am willing to admit that at some point I might have to give them up if I keep abusing them the way I am. I've abused them quite a bit. So we'll see how that goes. So check out audio-technica.com for these headphones. God, I love these headphones. And other headphones now. I've mentioned before, when I do go to Mix with the Masters to go see Chad Blake, I am definitely going to bring some noise-canceling headphones on that long flight, and I am not going to go with that other company either. I'm going to go straight to Audio Technica because I'm really constantly happy with these products. So I hope you are as well, and I hope you will consider that. So yeah, noise-canceling headphones from Audio Technica, as well as my trusted ATH M40Xs. I must fix them. I got to get them repaired. Okay, well, that's it. Let's get back into it with our friend Robert Scoville here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. Does your schedule allow for you to integrate other activities that complement your career, like teaching classes or anything like that, or giving discussions while you're on the road?
Yeah. I'm honestly really, really lucky with this piece of it. If the listeners don't know it, and I don't even know if you know it, I'm assuming you do it. I've been working for Avid full time for almost, what are we coming up on here, 12 years now, as a full time employee. And they not only give me the facility to go out and tour like this, but they encourage it. I mean, they want it because they want that kind of input on their products. Obviously, there's a marketing element of it that they can use to their advantage. And I take advantage of that and hold seminars and clinics all over the place. You know, like we will hold them during the day. And the Pedicamp has been incredibly gracious to allow us to do that. I mean, I will bring in 40, 50 people on a show day at 11 o'clock in the morning and let them hang out until 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And we will discuss every aspect of the consoles, the PA system, the tuning, the backline, whatever the subject matter is for the day. So yeah, I've done probably no exaggeration over 12 years of doing that. I bet I have run 3,000, maybe 4,000 people through that process.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. I've read that you're a big proponent of digital technology, especially in the live arena, excuse the pun.
Yeah.
I've watched your videos. I've seen you talk about this, and you seem really passionate about it.
I am. I actually love digital for live sound. I started out very, very pro analog. You know, obviously have a lot of experience in the studio, you know, a lot of programming, a lot of hearing programming in analog throughout 30 years of time. I mean, I've seen the entire gambit run here. You know, when I started in audio, there were no computers. There were no digital technologies in audio when I started in 1979. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe the first digital delay was around the corner, but that was it. So, you know, I have analog footprint on my programming on my brain, but there's an element of it in live that is a practical application of that. You know, I mean, coming up through the studio world, you know, you get used to using Pultex, you get used to using 1176s, you get used to what tape compression sounds like. And then when you got out into the live world, it's like, well, none of that's here, you know? So, you know, I mean, if you looked at my front of house rigs from, you know, the late 80s through, you know, into the 90s, probably into the early 2000s, you know, it looked like a big recording studio out there. I mean, I had tons of, you know, 1176s, Pulse Techs, Tube Techs, you know, all the stuff that I knew how to get sounds on in the studio. You know, we were using condenser mics. We had Neumanns over the kit, you know, all these kind of things, you know, trying to get that kind of vibe to it. And what digital did, especially once Avid or DigiDesign, however you want to look at it, got into the game, was they allowed us to easily pull those elements forward in the digital world. Mm-hmm. Meaning, okay, well, okay, yes, I can have a Fairchild in a plug-in form now. Is it exactly a Fairchild? No, it's not. Okay, is it 80% of a Fairchild? Well, maybe. Okay, I'll take it because I can use as many of them as I want out here. I can't go to the sound company and say, I need you to go out and buy a $38,000 Fairchild for me so I can use it on the vocal. I mean, it's just impractical. No one's going to do it.
I can't imagine, you know, even bringing a Fairchild on the road.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's exactly what I'm getting at. And then on top of it, you know, the whole concept, you know, I know in the early days of getting out on an analog console after being in the studio for quite a bit, you know, you would get things up and you'd just be like, man, what is missing? I mean, there's something missing here. There's an element of this that is not, like, I'm missing some glue or something here. And it was the tape compression. You know, it was tape compression. And it took me years to figure out that's what it was. It was like, oh my gosh, that's the element that is gone here. Again, that's something digital now gives us in the live sound world, is the ability to emulate tape compression. Because tape compression is not like anything else. It's not like a regular compressor. It's not like a tube compressor. Those are very, very different things. It's not like limiting. It's just this gooey glue element that happens to your audio when you record it in analog. Mm. And now we can emulate that out there. If you come out and look at my digital console, matter of fact, I think this is going to be in one of my upcoming blog series, and you look at my analog path on my console, or my plug-in path on my console, I should say, it's emulating an analog path. Like, I've got a saturator and a harmonics generator to be able to simulate some preamp overdrive. Mm-hmm. I've got Tube Tech, you know, Pultec wideband equalization. And I've got tape compression on all of the things that I would do just like I would do it in the studio. On the mix bus, I have a similar thing doing half-inch tape compression. You know, it's the same thing. I'm just trying to use it in digital form because I can't recreate that in analog out there. It's impractical. Can't do it.
Interesting. Selfishly, I have to ask. So you're getting ready to go on the road with Tom Petty again.
Going back out. Yeah, we got about 10, 12 shows left, something like that.
So oh, okay.
We're about ready to wrap it up.
Are you coming to the Bay Area?
Three
nights at the Greek. Okay. Yeah. Maybe I can talk with you. Coming out and seeing your rig, and
maybe we need to do a little cutaway interview there.
Oh yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, maybe I'll bring my camera and we could post that as well. Huh, interesting.
Bring it on,
yeah,
man.
We'll talk about that. Okay.
Bring your tennis shoes. We'll work out. We'll do the stair workout.
Oh, shit, you'll kick my ass.
Do a few push-ups. It'll get everything. It'll make the interview go really good.
We'll be mentally very aware.
That's right.
So what about diet? With this new workout regime, how has your diet changed? And I assume that's changed drastically on the road since, you know, long ago.
Well, compared to what it used to be. Yeah, sure. And I mean, we're at a good time now touring wise where there's a lot better food choices on the road out there. I mean, no doubt about it. I mean, the catering is far superior to what it was even 10 years ago. You know, okay. I mean, it's come a long way. But that said, I mean, if you're into this kind of fitness and into the kind of diets that I'm into right now, it's very, very challenging. You know, the food that is out there, you know, the wording that we would use for it in the circles that I run in is it's not clean food, you know, meaning, you know, there's a lot of processed food out there. And that's kind of the mainstay of what I'm trying to do with my food, is trying to get away from processed foods and try to make it very clean. It's not a 100% paleo diet, mm-hmm. but it's probably about 70% paleo, trying to keep all the processing out of your food. So that part of it is really, really challenging on tour because there's lots of processed foods out there. I've noticed even just this year being out with it, my diet tends to shift a lot more carbohydrate heavy. It's harder to get a lot of protein in. It's harder to get the balance of protein, fats, and carbs. You know, it's hard to get that out of balance, and it's easy to get it out of balance. You're eating out every day. I mean, you know, every day off, you're going to eat at a restaurant, you know, which is, you know, it's not the best in terms of just trying to keep balanced meals. You know, you have to really fight for it to do it.
Yeah. And there's great temptation, I'm sure, to just go back into old habits.
I mean, let's do the math. I mean, you work, you know, at least at the schedule I'm working, I'm in at, you know, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, and then we're finishing and we're rolling into the bus to get ready to, you know, to take off at 12:30, 1 o'clock at night, you know? So, I mean, that's 18-hour day, you know, I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And, you know, you're going to be exposed to at least 4 meals a day, and none the least of which is a full meal at 12 o'clock at night on that bus, you know? And that's the hardest one to kind of avoid, you know, especially if you kind of buy into this mentality. I can't believe we're talking about all this stuff right now. If you buy into this mentality of the 12-hour fast, which is from the time of your last meal, you know, try to fast and not have another meal until 12 hours later. And then all of your eating happens in that other 12 hours. So I, you know, I try to subscribe to that when I'm home, and I do a really good job of it. You know, so if I have dinner at 6 o'clock at night, a snack at 8 o'clock at night, I try to make sure and not have anything else till 8 o'clock the next morning. So get up the next morning, do my 6 a.m., 7 a.m. workout, come back with my protein shake at 8 o'clock, and off we go again, you know. But man, that to try to put that kind of regimen in place when you're on tour is virtually impossible. Because after an 18-hour day, you're hungry. I mean, you're ready to eat, you know, and so you're going to eat this meal and then jump in your bunk and go to sleep. It's just, it's not the best thing for you.
I had a discussion with Michael Beinhorn when he came on the show, and we talked about sugar. And, you know, I'm doing my best to try to avoid a lot of processed sugar and just, you know, sugar, just candy in general. Just, I used to go to the movies and, you know, I'd buy, you know, a box of sweet tarts and a box of something else and a cup of coffee and finish it all and be walking out of the theater kind of, you know, like vibrating. And I don't do that anymore. And I find that by not eating sugar, it kind of just keeps me emotionally much more stable, I think. I'm not emotionally unstable, but I mean, it just kind of keeps my mood kind of regular.
Yeah, sugar really, and especially processed sugar, is really that's the devil, if there is one, in my opinion. I mean, that's the one that you gotta eliminate from your diet, you know. And it's not to say you can't have anything sweet. There are plenty of ways to have things that are sweet. And for me, honestly, my Achilles heel is chocolate, man. I mean, I'm a chocoholic. So trying to find, you know, 80% cocoa chocolates and things like that, and try to make sure they're as sugar-free as possible, that's a big deal for me.
I want to switch gears a bit and talk a little bit about finances and stuff. And I know that you're probably scratching your head going, is this really what we're talking about? But if you have...
It's awesome. Don't get me wrong. No, it's awesome. Like I said, I just can't believe we're talking about these things. It's cool. I don't get a chance to let this out very often. It's nice.
Well, this is kind of the thing we do on Working Class Audios. We do talk a tiny bit about gear, but we really talk about lifestyle and how you handle different things. And so others can have a glimpse of like, oh, okay, it's not all, you know, glamour and stuff. It's, there's some real aspects to this. And the financial aspect is always a big mystery to a lot of people. What are some of the lessons you've learned in the years that you've been working, how to deal with your finances especially on the road?
Man, it's, I mean, gosh, we could spend 2 hours talking about this part of it. You know, you just got to, it's just one of those things that requires discipline if you're going to save your money, you know. I hate to break it down to being something that simple, but it needs to be that simple. I mean, you know, we have so many luxuries on the road, and I hope the government's not listening here, but maybe they will be. You know, I mean, we're paid a per diem, you know, we're paid a daily allowance in cash, you know, $35, $45 a day. But on show day, like I said, you got 4 catered meals provided to you. So, I mean, you have the ability to save that money. I mean, that might be $200 or $300 a week in your pocket. And if you don't go out and blow it on your days off, I mean, that can be a really good little nest egg to put away right on top of your salary, you know? So I think for a lot of guys, I mean, you know, I know when I was single and touring, you know, because I was touring just constantly. I mean, I was on the road constantly. I didn't want to have a home dragging me down financially. I didn't, you know, I put my stuff in storage, or, you know, we just come up with ways to, you know, survive and kind of live for 2 or 3 weeks at a time in between legs of tours, whatever, you know, where that would just become cost of doing business again, you know, where you, all the money you're saving because you're not paying a mortgage, well, you take that and use that to, you know, facilitate yourself for 2 or 3 weeks in between tours, you know, things like that. So there's ways to do it. I think I would always recommend to somebody, as early as you can get in the game, to get a financial planner. Mm-hmm. I mean, get a financial planner. And you may not get it the first time, but get somebody that you think you can trust, and certainly somebody that you can communicate to, and, you know, be real straightforward about what you want in terms of goals for your money. I mean, you just have to do it that way. Anything short of that really is just, it's gambling. You know, I mean, it's all gambling with your money.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's quite easy to spend money on frivolous things in the road too, just for maybe for entertainment's sake, or maybe just out of, you know, the pressure of being with a group of people and everybody spending money on some goofy thing. And then you end up
guilty as charged. Totally guilty as charged. I mean, I'm certainly not the model of, you know, financial greatness here sitting before you. I mean, I have certainly spent my share of money. I mean, I spent a lot of money on gear. I mean, I buy a lot of my own gear, and I'm terrible about turning it over and, you know, getting my money back out of it, you know, just things like that. So my wife will attest to that, because we have closets full of microphones and guitar amplifiers and everything else in this house. You know, I've taken over every piece of the house with it.
Do you continue to do studio work at all?
I've pulled back from it the last 10 years, honestly, just because between the touring and the work at Avid, you know, because I do a lot of design work and stuff for Avid as well. It's very demanding. Between those two things and the family, I almost feel guilty taking studio work, because I feel like I can't give it my all. It's like I have to just compromise my time into it. So I don't take as much as I used to. I actually ended up taking more live sound work locally as opposed to studio work. I used to come home and always do studio work, but now I take more live sound work locally. I got hooked up with this place called Lakeshore Entertainment here. They have they kind of promote this just beautiful venue here in right around Phoenix. It's in Tempe, on the campus there, called the Tempe Center for the Arts. It's this beautiful little 2,000 seat horseshoe, world class performance area. Mm-hmm. And they bring in a lot of top notch jazz and everything in there. So when they bring in big name jazz, they hire me in to mix it. So it's been a lot of fun. I've been having a great time doing that.
You're in Arizona. How long have you been living there?
I have been here since about 94. So coming up on 22, 23 years now. I moved here from Los Angeles. I lived in LA for about 12, 13 years. Talking about the family thing, I got to the point there where I wanted to raise my family, or start a family, I should say, not raise one. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to do it in Los Angeles. I'm sorry, LA guys. I just did not want to raise my kids in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I hear you.
And we had been through Phoenix a few times. And we just happened to be here, I think we had like a 3-night run here or something with Def Leppard, I think, at some point. And we decided to go out and looking for houses and stuff. And you know, I'd love to tell you it was this beautiful plan, but it wasn't. You know, the housing market in Los Angeles at that time was kind of crashing. This was in the late 80s, kind of crashing a little bit. And the housing market in Arizona was at the bottom of its run. So the houses were incredibly cheap here. Houses in Los Angeles were losing their value probably 10% a month. I mean, it was just crazy. So, you know, there was things that fueled us toward moving here. And I felt like I could live here and still work in Los Angeles, which I did for ages. You know, I mean, it was going from Phoenix to Los Angeles on Southwest Airlines is like a cab ride. I mean, it's nothing to get there. So, you know, I actually held a phone number in Los Angeles for a long time. If people called me up and wanted me to come in and work or something, I'd say, yeah, I can be there in a couple hours. And I'd go down and jump on Southwest Airlines and go over and work. You know, I mean, there was nothing to it. So I held on to that for a long time. And then at some point I just started realizing, you know, I don't need to live there to work there, you know, so.
That's great. Except for the heat.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The triple digit weather. That's a little bit of a game changer for me.
Yeah. I'm okay with the heat. I always have been. I never really had a problem with the heat here. I mean, I can go out. I mean, I went out running this morning. It's 108 here, you know, so, but it, you know, it's just a very dry, very different heat here than it is even. I mean, I'll take 110 in Arizona over 90 in San Francisco any day of the week.
I will agree with you on that. Yeah, definitely. Well, and I grew up in southern New Mexico. I'm no stranger to the heat, but I will agree with you on the 90 degree in San Francisco heat. That's awful.
Yeah, that's brutal. I've been there a couple of times for that. And it was just like, whoa, are you kidding me right now? Oh, man.
Yeah, that's pretty intense.
I mean, you know, I remember staying in hotels that didn't have air conditioning and stuff. You know, I mean, it was just like, because they just never got to those temperatures there.
Yeah. So. One of the questions I love to ask is, are there quotes that are important to you that, or phrases or things that motivate you personally or keep you on track for how you want to live your life or your career? Anything like that?
Honestly, the first one that comes to mind, and again, this was born out of the whole fitness thing, but it's so important to kind of have it. is show up, don't quit. I love that one, you know, and it kind of goes right hand in hand with, 90% of success is showing up. You know, you got to be there.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like, I'm trying to get that one across to my kids now. It's like, you got to go, you got to get involved, you know, screw competence at the beginning of it. You got to show up, you know, got to be there. And the other one is kind of revolves around this mentality that we kind of are always pressing here is stay in the fight. When it's looking its worst, that's when you need to stay in the fight. And you know, that one for me really resonates with live sound, because on a day to day, there are just tons of times that things are going to happen to challenge you, and where you just think, "Ooh, we may not have a show today." You know, I mean, that kind of thing. And you just got to stay in it, even in the confines of a mix where things are not going good inside the mix. You know, where you're just thinking, "Jesus, why can't I get that right tonight?" You know, stay in it. Don't give up on it. Stay in it and keep fighting for it until you get it. You know, don't give in. Don't give in. Here's a good quote for you for my mentality on the road. Anything worth doing is worth overdoing.
I like that. That kind of falls in line with, I was talking with Kevin Becca, who works over at Blackbird, and he was telling me John McBride, who runs Blackbird, he said his favorite quote from John is, don't let good be the enemy of great. So if there's something worth doing good, it's worth doing great.
Yeah, I like that. I'll give you the counterpart to that. This is one that Petty always threw at me, and I always loved it, was, hey, good is good. Good is good. We don't need to go on. It's like if we're working on getting a sound or something, it's like when you get it, move on.
Yeah. Or it's doing takes.
Yeah. I mean, you don't need to keep grinding on it to show me you're a great engineer. It's like, okay, that's the sound. Let's move on. You know,
I like that too.
Yeah. There's some context in that. You know, it's like, hey, we don't have to show that we know all the bells and whistles here. You know, we don't have to overcomplicate it at times. Put the mic on it, get the right guitar, the right amp, the right part. Okay, let's go.
And coming from Tom Petty, one thing that struck me in watching his shows over the years is just the sheer number of hits. He starts to sound like, oh, of course, there's this one. Oh, there's this one. And there's this one. And it just kept going on and on. And I thought, what a career that guy's had.
It's going to sound like I'm gloating saying this, but it's not. It's just the reality of it. When we're putting together the tour, the set list for the tour, et cetera, you could take the list of rejects that we don't play, and that would be a Hall of Fame career.
I know.
That's no exaggeration. I mean, I just look at it and go, how can we not play that? Well, wait a minute. We're not going to play that one? It's just, you go on and on. It's just amazing. Just amazing.
Final question. Career advice for those listening to this thinking, hey, live sound might be my thing. Mm-hmm. What would you have to say to that? What advice would you hand out?
You know, I try to give this advice to a lot of young people that are trying to get into this business. And honestly, I don't really care whether it's live sound or studio work here. I think it both applies, but I'll context it specifically for live sound is don't be in a hurry. Don't be in a hurry to succeed, because these years that it's going to take to develop you are important development. You know, you're not just going to walk out of school. You're not going to go to some sound company and work for 6 months and end up mixing the Rolling Stones. That's not the expectation. And you need that time to grow. I mean, it's the equivalent of taking a high school freshman and throwing him in the NFL. You know, there's something that happens in those years that has to happen. You know, so don't be in a hurry, and don't be afraid to take gigs that may have nothing to do with what you actually want to do. You know, especially in live sound, there are plenty of production areas of it that you can get involved in. And I honestly think it's one of my strongest assets as a live sound engineer is that I've had my hands in all of it at some point or another. You know, it gives you good command of the gig when you're actually sitting in the hot seat, you know, to be able to empathize and be able to understand everybody's position fluently, understand what they have to do, what is on their shoulders, you know, and it can make you a good captain of the ship, you know, if you understand all of it. If you only understand the 2 feet that are sitting right in front of you, you know, what does that mean? Okay, great. You got command over that 2 square feet that you're sitting in right now. Live sound is a lot bigger than that. It's a lot more going on than just what you're doing on the console, you know?
Wow. Well, great advice and good information. Well, Robert, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me here on the show. And it's been a pleasure having you on. And I look forward to seeing you in Berkeley when you come to town, and we'll chat further then. But yeah, be safe out on the road and keep up that diet and that whole workout thing you got going on, man. That's inspiring.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to do this too. I love doing these kind of things, and especially kind of getting to talk about things we don't normally talk about, you know, and don't have to get up here and parrot a lot of things I've already talked about. That was really nice. That was a nice change. I appreciate it.
That's a lot of the guys say that. They're always like, I love that we didn't talk really about gear.
I don't know the numbers anymore anyway. You know, I just go, it's the black one with the silver thing. I don't know what number it is anymore.
It's the one with the green interface.
Right. Yeah. It's got the big knob on it. I don't remember.
Well, cool. Well, I'll stay in touch and we'll hook up in Berkeley and look forward to that. And thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Take care. Robert Scoville here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. Do you know how lucky I am to get to interview these people? I can't tell you how lucky I feel, but it's an honor, and I'm honored that you all continue to listen. And so I want to thank Robert. I want to thank you all. So we are out of time. So we're going to thank Cliff Truesdell and Chuck Smith and Cole Williams. And we have to thank our sponsors, GearSluts.com, Lawton Audio, Focal Monitors, Universal Audio, and Audio Technica. And thank you. I appreciate it. Take care. Hey, I know many of you are aware of this, but for those of you that aren't aware, Working Class Audio sponsors the forum over at gearspace.com called Audio Life. And quite simply put, it's a place where audio professionals can go to talk with other audio professionals about things other than audio gear, including life hacks, work-life balance, health and hearing loss. You know, if you want to talk with other audio professionals who can identify with what your lifestyle is like and how it relates to things going on in the world outside of audio, this is a great place to go and check out. So head on over to gearspace.com, check out Audio Life, many of the same topics that we discuss here on the show on gearspace.com. So check that out.